It's Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station FM 107.1. And joining us this afternoon, of course, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And as we begin the program, just to remind you, do not hesitate to give them a call. 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050, or go to their website at harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, please, harvellandcollins.com. And with that, Cecil, Wes, good morning, or good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Lockwood. So, Lockwood, last time we spoke about a legal word known as the fiduciary. And basically, Lockwood, a fiduciary is a person that holds property for the benefit of another. And, of course, usually it is not their own property. It is the property of the other that they are holding in a trust worthy capacity pursuant to a document, many times a trust document, that directs them how to handle those monies. This document also is known as the infamous last will and testament. Mm-hmm. An executor is a fiduciary. After all, an executor is holding money, gathering the assets together, marshaling them together, and then distributing them according to the will. But in the meantime, the executor many times has access to all of the assets of the estate and therefore is very much so holding property for the benefit of another. So the word fiduciary is kind of a catch-all word for an executor, a trustee, and then, of course, as we've discussed, the agent under a power of attorney is a fiduciary. Again, they are holding money and operating funds and other assets for the benefit of the principal, the person who appointed them under the power of attorney. So a trustee, a power of attorney, an executor, all of these people are fiduciaries within the definition of the law. Now, Wes and I see a lot of these kinds of files on a daily basis, and right out of the gate, one of the things that Wes and I would advise is that if you are a fiduciary, let's begin the process with seeking just a bit of legal advice. Mm-hmm. If you go to a good law firm, and there are many good law firms, the lawyer is more than likely going to lead you. If the lawyer needs to help you, they will help you. And if the attorney feels that they do not need to help you, just dot an I, cross a T, then most good lawyers are going to tell you that. We mm-hmm. certainly do that at our office. We don't accept the engagement for every single file that clients come in to talk to us about, or rather the public. Sometimes it's just not necessary. And yet other times it's very necessary. And it's good to sometimes start this process on the front end. Just yesterday, I had a gentleman, very nice guy, come in, and he was the executor of his dad's estate for the benefit of six children. He was one of the children. They were all the natural children of his dad. The estate was pretty considerable, and for whatever reason, he went about it and has been in it for about a year and a half or more without any kind of legal advice. And so I's and T's are all dotted and crossed backwards. Ooh. And the clerk of court is upset with him and has sent out the sheriff because he hasn't filed the appropriate inventories. Uh-huh. And so finally he came in to see, you know, a good lawyer, Harvell and Collins. And so we are now officially aboard for him. But it's going to take us longer, Lockwood, to go back and unwind and start all over again than it would have been if we had just been in the gate to begin with. Now, again, he's an executor, and that's one type of fiduciary. But whether you're a trustee, whether you're an agent under a power of attorney, whether you are an executor, it is advisable that you seek some guidance right at the beginning of your involvement. And maybe the lawyer will only need to dot an I or cross a T. But let me let Wes kind of comment on some of this. Wes, of course, at our law firm sees the back end of these files many times, many times, where they really have gone astray. And due to certain actions or misactions, the next thing you know, we're in litigation. Right, Wes?
Yeah, no question about that. Of course, we try to stay out of litigation if we can for our clients. But certainly ready, willing, and able and eager to proceed forward with litigation when it gets to the point that we need to proceed in that way. So when we're talking about a breach of fiduciary duty, as Cecil has gone through in the first 5 or 10 minutes here, there's certain fiduciary duties that are established just by the very nature of what the office is. He's touched on just about every one of those. That would be an executor of an estate. That would be a trustee of a trust. That would be a agent or a power of attorney. That would be anyone, holding assets for someone else in some official, capacity. And that creates a fiduciary relationship. In addition to that, you can also have a fiduciary relationship without that technical cap, so to speak, being put on someone's head. What I'm referring to there is that if based on the course and dealings of the relationship, if it's like a family relationship and there's a close relationship where it's a special relationship of trust and confidence, where someone still confident someone else, like let's say that the mother allows the son to access her account for purposes of paying her bills, mm-hmm. and there's special trust and confidence that has been imposed or provided to the son, then that would potentially be found factually as a fiduciary duty as well. So we often have cases, Lockwood, where there's a relationship such as that was never formalized into a power of attorney or trust document, but there was some type of relationship where it was a fiduciary relationship. So we're in our lawsuits, we're alleging that there was a fiduciary relationship, even though there's not this formality of the document. So
a good word there, Wes, is the word implied. Uh-huh. Of course, the legal word is constructive trust, but Lockwood, what Wes is explaining is that even though there's not a document that the person is acting under, it's just implied that they are using monies of another for the benefit, and they, of course, are held to the standard of a fiduciary. Uh-huh. It's implied that those were the facts.
That's correct. And, the listeners may... And you, Lockwood, I guess you're a listener too, would maybe be thinking, okay, we got it. We understand this is kind of basic. You have to make sure that you don't misuse, the funds of mom, or if I'm a trustee, I have to act in the best interest of the beneficiary, not myself. I've got that. That makes sense, common sense. But in the world of litigation, the existence of a fiduciary duty changes the complexion of the case significantly. And what I mean by that is that if we establish that there is a fiduciary duty, then the burden of proof then shifts to whoever that fiduciary is, and it's their responsibility then to show that they did not breach the fiduciary duty. If we have a claim for breach of fiduciary duty and we're able to prove that there was a fiduciary relationship, then it's not, let's say, if I'm the plaintiff, it's not my responsibility on behalf of my client, the plaintiff, to prove that this person breached their duty in their office. The burden shifts back to them to prove they did not. So they basically have that puts quite a monkey on their back to have to come forward with evidence as to their activities and explanation as to why they did the things that they did, or potentially the things that they didn't do. But normally a breach of fiduciary duty is going to be more, based on affirmative actions by the fiduciary as opposed to failure to act. I mean, those cases are pretty rare. Oftentimes, these cases that are breach of fiduciary duty, you know, they're going to include with them claims like constructive fraud, mm-hmm. you know, fraud, these type of claims. And the different, really, fiduciary duty and constructive fraud are like kissing cousins. I mean, they're like the same claim. The only difference between a constructive fraud claim and a breach of fiduciary duty claim is that when the fiduciary is breaching their duty to benefit themselves, then you meet the elements of a constructive fraud claim. And when you have a constructive fraud claim, if you're able to prove that, then you get into punitive damages, damages for punishing your actions. And additionally, the breach of fiduciary duty claim carries with it a 3-year statute of limitations, where we can look back 3 years to the activities of the violator, as we say, the fiduciary. But a constructive fraud claim has a 10-year statute of limitations, so it gives us a much broader swath as far as temporal limitations and time limitations as far as how far back we can look at the activities of the fiduciary and bring them into the fold, into consideration.
I want to step into this real quickly, if I could. I just want to remind folks, we're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins, and that was Wes Collins a moment ago. Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins, and I'm going to give the number one more time. It's for this is the reason for my question, as a matter of fact. 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050, or at harvellandcollins.com. Wes, Cecil, you know, you brought up the topic of constructive trust, an implied trust. And you've got a lot of instances, I would imagine, out there where, to your point earlier, Cecil, I'm taking care of my mother's accounts. I'm signing the checks for her. I'm paying the bills. She has all of her faculty, mind you, but she just doesn't she's just handed it over to me, and I'm responsible. So in that regard, I need to be very cautious, I'm thinking, and number one, document every activity, but two, keep in mind that, and of course I have siblings, that I need to make sure that anything that even my mother suggests to me, or my parent, whoever, father, that I have documentation on her request that I go ahead and buy the new car and put it in my name, for example, or something of that nature. I better have a documentation. I don't think a lot of people think that thought.
Absolutely. Kind of a lot of issues out of that factual scenario. You know, communication is just evidently, Lockwood, communication for all of us is a challenge, isn't
right.
it?
Yes.
I mean, in every aspect
yes,
of living, we can't have enough communication. And so many times, hurt feelings, mm-hmm. Not just hurt feelings, but things occur because we just didn't communicate quite like we should communicate. And yet, communication is really where fiduciary duty with family members begins. The family member might not like what you're communicating. They might not like the accounting that you send, saying uh-huh. that the following things have happened. But just because you think they might not like it doesn't mean that you shouldn't communicate to them about it. Because you've got the double whammy coming at you if there's no communication, which is the number one, that I don't like what you did, but number two, you didn't tell me about it. We encourage transparency in everything that we do relative to fiduciary law. powers of agents under powers of attorney should render accountings to family members, executors, of course, the same, trustees, the same, so that there's an open exchange of information. So this scenario that you have presented, Lockwood, where the son is taking over his mother's affairs, and maybe there isn't a power of attorney in place, maybe there isn't a trust document,
right,
but mom has asked him to do the following for her and on her behalf, and he's using her money.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, if he's got siblings, then it would be a very, we would recommend that he communicate that and open up the door for communication. Because then you can't really be faulted for someone saying, well, you never told me that you were going to do that with mom's money.
I'm just thinking a particular scenario where, mm-hmm. you know, the son is taking the mother around. The vehicle that he's using is uncomfortable for her. So she says, go ahead and buy the car because you're driving me around. You're my Uber driver. And of course, I go and do that. I buy the nice car that she's suggested that I buy. And she's going to pay for it and so forth. I'm thinking in the process, and I'm taking this far afield, I know, but I can imagine this has happened. And the other aspect of this, I know that this is not a legal document or a confirmed relationship. However, it strikes me, Cecil, Wes, that it would be advisable for the sibling or the child to say, you know what, let's just take this to an attorney. Let's just make sure that we're dotting the I's and crossing the T's. Because you said something a few moments ago, Wes, there is a financial penalty in the case of constructive fraud. This would be a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, I mean, I think transparency is key right there. But if we're talking about, you know, mom saying, okay, you know, you're driving me around, I can't drive anymore, you know, my car is old, your car is old, I want you to use my money to get a new car.
Right.
I think the right way to do that would be, fine, let's buy mom a new car and put it in mom's name.
Okay.
Don't put it in the son's name. And then if it's her intent for that car to pass to the son, or the daughter, whomever it may be, upon her death, well, let's just make sure that our lawyer has our estate planning documents in place so that happens. But you're not really breaching any, I mean, as a matter of law, you're not breaching a fiduciary duty by using her money to buy her a vehicle.
Right.
She doesn't have the driver of the car. So, you know, there's just a right way to do things and a wrong way to do things. So, moreover, you know, there's multiple layers of all the things that we do, and we have to be really good as lawyers in a lot of different areas so we don't create issues for our clients.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, mom's in a situation where she is interested in buying a vehicle, but putting it in the son's name. Well, if mom has to go into a care facility at some point in time in the next 5 years, then that's going to be seen as a gift. And if she would otherwise be entitled to adult Medicaid services to cover her cost of care, we would, under that scenario, wish that we hadn't done that, because we're going to have to undo that gift.
Uh-huh.
And deal with that sanction. So, because that would be, you know, a uncompensated transfer of an asset for the benefit of the son.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that kind of carries us over to, you know, having a caregiver agreement in place. It carries over into, you know, a lot of areas. And moreover, if she bought a vehicle in her name, if we're talking about the implications of, you know, how it would affect her eligibility for long-term care services through the state and federal government, then, you know, she can own a vehicle. It doesn't matter what the price of the vehicle is. She can own one vehicle. So there's lots of reasons to do it a certain way under that scenario, not just the reason of, oh, let's make sure everything is squeaky clean so nothing appears as though there's a breach of the fiduciary duty. I mean, there's other implications And that carries us, you know, kind of to the next thing, Lockwood, that Cecil and I have to be aware of when we're advising our clients or dealing with actions that they've taken maybe after the fact, is not only do you have, you know, make sure that you're staying between the lines, so to speak, staying in your lane with regard to breach of fiduciary duty potential issues, not only are we dealing with secondarily, but just as important, transfers that could create a sanction relative to Medicaid issues, long-term adult Medicaid, but there are potentially tax implications, minimal in this, or probably none in this scenario we just talked about, but we can't turn a blind eye to that possibility when we're dealing with our clients. So, you know, you've got to be a jack of all trades in this particular area, I mean, to a certain extent. I mean, obviously, if someone called me and asked me to help them with their speeding ticket, I wouldn't know even where to begin.
Right.
That's not our area of practice. So we stay in our lane, you know, with regard to these things. But there are certainly multiple layers in the, you know, complexity of the kind of web that we live in with breach of fiduciary duty issues and the incredible expense now of long-term health care and what benefits there are to help folks so they don't lose their home and maybe other assets from that. You know, obviously the tax code is something that's always a changing thing. These are all items that we have to brush up on and we have to stay up to speed on, not by just practicing every day and reading every day and reading cases every day. That's just what we do in our representation of clients, but also going to continuing legal education seminars because, you know, the law is not the same as it was in a lot of these areas when Mr. Harvell finished law school many years ago or when I finished law school many years ago. It changes.
Lockwood, one of the very typical, you know, almost everyday factual scenarios that Wes is kind of dancing around and talking about this is that, oh, Mr. Harvell, I want to deed my house to my two children.
Right.
Or I went and got a deed, and I probably shouldn't have done it, but I went ahead and deeded my house to my two children.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, you know, first of all, there's a very significant tax consequence in that that's a gift of a home while you're living, and your children now are going to lose a step up in tax basis to the fair market value if it had passed through your estate. So there is a tax consequence, a significant one, in the capital gain treatment of the property as a result of the deeding. Also, of course, as Wes was mentioning, there is, you know, a look-back period for Medicaid qualification, five-year look-back period, and if you've just deeded property to your children, then you're going to disqualify yourself for that five-year period, unless, of course, we then come along and undo it. In other words, fix it. The other thing about deeding your home, and I am glad this came up today, it kind of through left field, but it's such an important topic, is that, you know, you deed your home to your child, you now are making your home subject to the twists and turns of the good thing called life. Of your children. What if they go through a divorce? What if they have a significant medical expense? What if they are in an accident and it's deemed to be their fault? What if they have a liability? What if they have a bankruptcy? So all of a sudden, you have the sheriff coming to your door, to your home that you bought and paid for, you know, years and years and years ago, and there's a problem with the ownership of the home because it was deeded to your children. So we at our law firm really it's just rare indeed. I mean, one or two a year, if that, that we will agree to do a deed to children. It's just exceptional. It's just almost always a mistake to do that. But yet, the general public hears it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's best to go ahead and deed your home to your children. Go ahead and go to that lawyer and get that done, or get a deed off the internet.
Right.
Go to the register of deeds and change the title over to your children. Well, you know, that's a mistake.
The other aspect of this, I know we were talking about fiduciary responsibility, and of course I brought up the topic of an individual, but the other aspect of this, as you mentioned a moment ago, is the issue of deeds and titles and the fiduciary responsibility of those, because there are some times when a parent says they want to do something and the trustee or the agent is resistant to that. That's something that where the benefit of a legal representation such as Harvell and Collins provides would be beneficial, would it not?
Yeah, we do. Or to the child.
Right.
I mean, sometimes it's the child that, you know, calls and says, Mom wants to do this. Mom has had me call you,
right,
you know, Mr. Harvell, in order to have her home deeded to me and my sister. So, yes.
You know,
but we're usually able to, well, not all, usually, almost always, able to get that back on track again.
Okay, and then of course the other question I have, and related to a trustee, is in the handling of stocks and liquid. I'll call them liquid assets, but particularly stocks and bonds. The responsibility of a trustee. How do they do that without, if you will, getting close to those boundaries?
Well, obviously, I mean, all of that asset, stocks, bonds, so on and so forth, I mean, we have to be in a situation there where obviously those assets are being used for the benefit of the person, of the principal. So we're not cashing in stock or bonds and buying things for ourselves if we're the
right
the child. But moreover, if we are, you know, in control of these assets as trustee, power of attorney to a certain extent or whatever, then there's a rule called the prudent investor rule.
Okay.
And basically what that rule is exactly what it says. You need to act prudently in your responsibilities in investing these assets. You don't need to decide, hey, I'm going to take Mom's entire retirement account or Dad's retirement account, and I think it'd be a good idea to invest in coal mines in West Virginia in this private equity situation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that probably would not be very, very prudent. You need to be, you know, under management with someone who's a professional, most likely, and to be diversified. That would be prudently investing the asset. And in that, you don't need to be, obviously, if Mom or Dad are in advanced age. I mean, we don't need to be overly aggressive with investing either, because that's their retirement account. They need it for what? Their retirement. They're not for long-term gains. They're looking for to have that asset to use to live on. So the prudent investor rule would be that would be what would apply there.
We're talking with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins, and we've been talking about the issue of fiduciary responsibility. And I was intrigued as we wrap it up, Cecil and Wes. And again, remind you that number, 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050. I was impressed by the comment that you have so many different aspects of guidance for fiduciary responsibility from every aspect of living, everything from asset management to the activities, day-to-day activities. As I wrap it up, is there sort of a bullet point activity that you go through with those that are faced with the responsibility of an executive or a trustee or an agent for a family?
Well, there's no, you know, one thing, Lockwood, or one concept that's discussed. There's probably several. Maybe we can go into those on another program. But I think where we landed today in this great discussion with you, Lockwood, is just, you know, go to your good lawyer and ask questions. Just
uh-huh.
Don't go out and do a deed on your property or
mm-hmm.
sell an automobile and put it in your name. All of these little things that we've been discussing, you know, go and ask some questions about these things. These are good concepts that good lawyers know about. And it's better to get some advice on the front end than to take an action and then regret later on that we took that action. So I think where people I know that people, Wes and I both know, that folks are nervous about going to their lawyer. Mm-hmm. You know, what are you going to charge? I can't afford it. Well, ask. You know, ask the question.
Right, right.
What is this going to cost?
Yep.
At our office, we try our best. It's not always the case at Harvell and Collins, but a lot of our files do not have a consultation fee.
Mm-hmm.
Some do. Some of Wes's files, litigation files, just have to, but because it's going to be very time intensive on the front end just to hear all of the facts, so we have to charge some sort of consultation fee. But a lot of our planning, our state planning, our trust planning, our fiduciary law, our estate settlement, we allow there to be an hour of complimentary consultation.
Right.
So again, ask questions, and don't be afraid to seek advice. I think that might be kind of the way to conclude today's program.
As you pointed out earlier, the issue of having to unravel some of these problems becomes even more costly. I want to thank Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins, and remind you the number 252 area code 726-9050. Just call and ask. That's all it requires. Just call and ask, or go online to harvellandcollins.com. Let's talk legal with Harvell and Collins. Cecil, Wes, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Lockwood.